I want to start tonight with talking about. I think I'm going to go back and do a little bit to help the people that are new here kind of get your bearings of where we are and what we're talking about over the course of this year. So if you're, for those of you that are new to Sims, every year in January, Tim and I come up with a theme, some topic that we want to talk about all year. So we spend the whole year talking about it. And this year it happens to be a series of 10 Zen stories called the Ox Herding Stories. And they're pretty important and significant practice tools in Zen. Even though we are a Vipassana group, insight meditation group, these stories are really based in Zen practice and how Zen practitioners are kind of taught how they are along the way in their practice. But the stories are interesting and they are a great way to think about practice itself, both practice where I am on the whole scheme of enlightenment. The talk of enlightenment, and do I even believe in enlightenment? And so there's that aspect of the Zen stories that we talk about over the course of the 10 pitchers. And we happen to be on the third pitcher starting this month. We take each pitcher a month at a time. So at the end of these 10 pitchers, ultimately we're getting to this place of enlightenment and what awakening, enlightenment, the experience of it. In the bigger frame of that, that's one way you could look at your practice. Where am I on this trajectory of on my way or on this path towards awakening or enlightenment, however you think about it? And being on the third pitcher, we're at the beginning of the getting on my way to enlightenment or to awakening. But another way you could also look at these pictures, which was very important for me in my practice, is where am I in any given moment towards awakening or towards enlightenment? Where would I be in any given moment? Meaning that in any given moment, how open, how receptive, how willing am I to see, am I willing to see beyond the limitations of my ordinary thinking in any given moment? So it doesn't necessarily mean that I'm awakened in totality, but could I awaken in any given moment and see beyond the limitations of my habits, my patterns, my just ordinary way of looking at life? And could I be in an ordinary moment with an awakened or an enlightened understanding? And so these pictures, while they point both to the larger framing of the path, they also point to a moment by moment, how we live our lives. Tim and I are not Zen practitioners, just so we all are clear. So we are really sharing these stories based on our own understanding and our own practice and where we are and how we approach practice itself. But it is not... I'm hoping that you don't consider this as the teachings on the ox herding tales, that you really see this as a teaching mechanism or a teaching tool that would really help us just begin to look at our practice. That's what I really think this is all about. And for those of you that have been with us since January, what I'm hoping you're seeing over the course of these tales, and maybe we could talk about this during the, you know, when we open it up for questions, you know, comments and answers, and at the end, what I'm hoping that you're seeing is you're actually looking at your practice and paying attention to your practice itself. That's what this is really all about. Can you look at your practice and see what's happening in your practice and sort of let go of the notion that meditation is just something that's going to help me be calm? Because for those of us that have practiced in any length of time, calm is not necessarily the thing that I would say is associated with meditation. So I want to talk a little bit about this third picture, but first I want to talk about the first two for the people that are new. The first picture is really about a yogi that is, which reminds me, Cheryl, we're going to put that picture, we're going to have that picture up, right? Is that my screen? Is that what that is? Is that the picture?
No, we're still on number two, right? I got to change up.
Yeah. So how am I going to put the picture up so we can go over it? I actually have to have, I can share a screen.
You can share a screen.
Yes, I can share the screen and we can see it here too, right? Okay. So while you're working on that, I'm going to talk about the first two pictures. So the first picture is a yogi who is searching, and they're just searching. And it's where we are before we ever step on the path at all. We are basically searching for some way to deal with the difficulties of life. We're just searching for some way to get a grasp and understand, you know, it is hard living as an adult or just living in the world. And how in the world can I find some degree of happiness and joy in the world the way it is? And so we pretty much look for all kinds of things. It could be a new car. It could be a new job. It could be a new partner. It could be anything. We're just constantly looking for something. And then we come along to this second picture where this yogi begins to see glimpses of footprints. There begins to be this glimpse that maybe this thing that I hear about meditation, I hear about Dhamma, I hear about Buddhist teachings, and maybe there's something to this. Maybe if I really start looking at it a little bit, there may be something to all of this. And we get these little glimpses that show up in our practice that kind of point to, yeah, this is, there might be something to this. You know, I've sat a little bit. Some of the Zen teachers that I listened to and read from, they say that the second picture, you haven't even started practicing yet. But I kind of, in my own practice, feel like that second picture is when I am just starting to practice. I don't really understand it at all, one iota. It does not make any sense that anybody would keep returning to the breath, or why would anybody do that? And meditation itself doesn't seem to have any kind of, it doesn't make any sense to me. And yet I notice that I don't snap at someone when I usually would. Something happens, these little glimpses that I am not sure it's related to my meditation, but I think it is. And so there's a kind of a way where these footprints, I'm still searching. I still want something. I'm not really sure that meditation is it, but I'm beginning to get a sense that maybe there's something to this meditation. Maybe there's something to it. And then we get to this month, where you actually see the ox. So I do need to tell you with this ox, they're called ox herding tails, and so you see the ox, but they're also called the bull. It's interchangeable, bull, ox, same thing. And what this ox represents is the genuine you, the unconditioned you, the being that is not controlled by habit, that's not controlled by patterns, that's not completely controlled by the conditions that go on around us. And so we're trying to find, in the first two pictures, we're trying to find, I shouldn't say the first two pictures, the first few pictures, we're trying to find something outside of ourselves. We think there's something outside of ourselves that's going to help us have a better life. And we're still looking for that. And then we come to this third picture where we actually see the ox. And the second picture, I don't know if you can go back, Cheryl, and see the second picture, but I wanted to, there's something that, oh good, thank you. You see here in the second picture, can you see the little footprints here? What's significant about this third picture is that in the second picture, you see the little bitty footprints. And so the practitioner is, you haven't actually seen the ox and you haven't seen this, the ox that you're trying to get. The thing that's going to make your life better. The thing that's the path, the final kind of, understanding that you're going to get. You don't have it, but you have seen the footprint. So you know something's there. You know, there is something, but you haven't seen it, but you can see that those footprints are relatively small. So you have created in your mind what you think the path is all about, what you think this is going to be about. That's what the point of the second picture is. There's a way in which the glimpses seem to point to, oh, I know what this is going to be about. I know what this is going to do. I know how this is going to help me out. I know what to do. I got it. I just need to find this ox and I can get it under control. So then if we go to the third picture now, this is where we're at this month. What you see is the backside of a massive being. That's what you see. And there is a realization that begins to happen in our practice when we see the truth of the path itself. The best way to describe this is like a mystical experience. That's the best way I can describe it. So what it means is it's not necessarily some big seeing lights and, you know, big drama like some people describe some mystical experience. It's not so much like that. As much as it is, you can be sitting here in a meditative sit in Sims. You come in, you're sitting here, just a regular old Monday night, no big deal. You start sitting and then there's this moment when, I don't know, sounds just sound differently. They sound real. You've let go of thinking and you feel like you are present here, and the sounds are, the body feels different. The sounds seem louder, or they seem more glorious. The body sitting feels glorious. There's this, it's almost like the whole moment itself is glorious. That's probably the best words I can think of it. It sounds like I come from like my Christian upbringing, but it sounds majestical. It feels like I see something, or you feel this sense of unconditional love. Like, I could love everybody. I don't even care anymore. I could love everybody. I just don't want to have to choose whether I love someone or not. I'm up for loving everybody. And it's not coming from your thinking mind. You just feel it. I just feel like it is true that I could love everyone. Or you're listening to a talk and you're almost moved to tears by what the teacher's saying. I can remember time sitting at Sims when we were downstairs in Keystone. Oh my God. And Rodney would be giving these Dhamma talks and I felt like there were angels in the ceiling, like flying around. I'm just sitting here like, what in the world is going on? It's like that. It doesn't last for long periods of time. Some people it might last a long time, but it doesn't have to. But I realized there was something real about this path. It's not just, am I going to be a nicer person? Is it somehow or another, am I going to be nice? It's not that. You begin to see that there is something to what great spiritual leaders are talking about. And they are not talking about just random stuff. The idea of awakening seems real, and it seems completely possible that I could let go of myself. So in this picture, you can see that the body of the ox is much bigger than the footprints would imply that it is. And that is what, and you only see a portion of the ox, and you begin to realize that what it's going to take to control this ox is a lot more than you have. You didn't bring enough rope. You didn't bring enough, you know, muscle power. You're going to need to go back and get some people to help you kind of grab a hold of this thing and get a hold of it, because you're still trying to grab a hold of this thing and control it. You're still in ordinary mind here, but you're just realizing almost like this is something I need in my life, and I'm willing to do whatever it takes to get it. So let's look at the way these ox herding tales go is there's this, both this picture and there is a verse that goes with it. And so in this verse, I hear the song of the nightingale. The sun is warm. The wind is mild. Willows are green along the shore. And this idea that no bull can hide here. What I think this is pointing to is that usually these moments of the majestic seeing of the path, they almost come with quiet moments when you're not expecting it. You are sitting in meditation, or you're sitting listening to a talk, or you're just walking down the street. You're just in an ordinary moment, and the moment is as it is. But you are not expecting to see this bull, and you see it. It seems to rise up out of the ordinariness of the moment. You can also notice in this verse, the yogi is not searching. In the previous verses, the yogi was looking for something, and here the yogi seems to be experiencing the moment, but they are not looking for anything. And this kind of understanding of the fullness and the realness of Dhamma comes to us in an ordinary moment when we're not looking for it, when somehow we can just begin to see the truth of what it is that we've stumbled upon. In this picture, you do not see the yogi. Here, you just see the massiveness of the bull itself or the ox, or what you're really seeing, I think, is the truth of the Dhamma is what you see. But you don't see the whole of the Dhamma because the Dhamma is too vast. We just see the truth of it in some moment in time, almost out of the blue. This one teacher said, it's sort of like you thought you were going to go get a puppy. You're on the path and you see the little footprint, so you think you're going to get a puppy. And then you see that it's a dragon and you realize that you're like in trouble. Somebody said that it's both awesome and terrifying at the same time. And I want to talk a little bit about the why it's awesome and terrifying at the same time in just a minute. But I just want to spend some more time talking about just why this is so important. Because this stage here is very, very critical on the path. It's for most of us, I don't know about you, but most of us, I think, from the most of the yogis I talk to, no one in their world practices when they come into the Dhamma. They're like coming into the Dhamma in a world where everybody else is doing something else. And they're coming into this practice. And so the glimpses really kind of help us. The little footprints kind of help us stay a little bit. But it doesn't seem real to us until this third picture, when this picture is almost like the place when you decide that the Dhamma is an inherent part of your life. I don't know how, I don't know what, but this Dhamma is what I am bringing into my life. And you are going to practice in the Dhamma regardless of what happens with the people around you. You may not necessarily tell anybody you're practicing, but you are going to practice for yourself because this is real. This is not an illusion. Let me see if there's anything else I want to talk about this. The other thing that some teachers talked about was that this experience, when you actually see the ox, is an experience, it's a direct experience. So this is the first time you have a direct experience of the Dhamma. It's not an experience. It's not like the other two pictures where you are imagining what the Dhamma is going to do to your life. In this picture is the first time you know the Dhamma is going to change your life. Someone said that you see this, the realness of Dhamma, and you realize that this thing is going to turn your life upside down. That's what we come face to face with. When we come face to face with this bull, the back of it. So there's a realization that, yeah, I'm willing to give whatever I need to give to stay in this practice. And at the same time, I realize, it's not going to be the same. I remember when I came to, I've had this moment more than once. So the first time I had it was when I came to the beginning class. And I'd say the first time I had it is when I read this book I was looking for another way to practice because it wasn't working for me, for the practice I was doing. And so I read this book by Trungpa Rinpoche. I was in the bookstore. I read this book and I read it and I didn't understand what he was talking about at all. And so I took the book home to begin to practice with it. And I remember sitting, practicing with this this book and reading. It was just, some of you know, it was the 59 slogans of Tibetan practice. And I'm reading a slogan and I was sitting there trying to meditate, reading this slogan, trying to meditate. And I had this experience of just, I don't know how to describe it, but I felt like my whole life was about to change. Like my whole understanding was about to change. And I just remember sitting there feeling the realization that something I was learning was going to change me in a way that I didn't even know how it was going to happen. And I was both filled with this sense of, oh my God, I'm so ready for this. And at the same time, I was like, oh my God, how am I going to tell my mama about this? I was like, I don't even know if I can tell her. We have to keep that to ourselves. And another time I've had the same experience was the first time I had an interview with Rodney. I went to his house and I had this interview, and I remember going through this interview with him, and I remember him talking to me, and I don't understand a word he's saying, but there was something about the way he was talking that I will never forget. The feeling I had when I left his house and I walked out the door, and I had this sense that I had just been in the experience of something huge. I don't understand what the hell he was talking about, but I know he was talking about something. He was talking about something, and it was big, and it was just, the whole thing felt real. So it isn't that I saw something in reality, like you're looking at this ox and you see a physical body. I think the ox is representing the direct experience. When we have a direct experience of Dhamma, that you know you're having that experience, and at the same time, it seems beyond you. Like, I'm not quite sure I could even explain it to another person. This is what I think this is pointing to, is this direct experience. So all of these pictures, though, they come with a caveat, because at the same time, this is what this awesome, the whole thing is awesome, and it's terrifying at the same time. Because alongside having the experience of this direct experience of the possibility that you could awaken, is the realization of just how limited you are. The realization of what it means to live in a conditioned world. You can see how habitual you are. You see the truth of how difficult it's going to be to get past some of your habits, some of your patterns. You can see just the basic difficulty of trying to meditate. So you have this magistical experience, and oh, I'm going to meditate, so I'm going to sit down every day. I got it. I'm going to sit down 45 minutes every day. And then you see how difficult it is just to remember to meditate every day. And if you do remember to meditate every day, then you are coupled with this thing that it's sort of like, I will never stop my mind from thinking. It'll never happen. It's like I had this majestical experience that I believe awakening is possible. And now I can't even get myself to stay with the breath for 2 minutes. How in the world am I ever going to get through this? This is where we are in this picture. So this phrase, no bull can hide here, that's what the direct experience gives you, is a sense that this is real. It's not pretend. It's not fake. But then what artist can draw that massive head, those massive horns, majestic horns? What it's pointing to, I think, is that how do you finish the story? How do you do this? How do I get to that actual awakening moment? I can see that it's possible. I know it's possible. I felt it. But how in God's name am I going to make that happen? And that is where the terrifying part comes. It's like you have, there's a quote that Joseph Goldstein said one time at the teacher training. He said, the Dhamma is vast and impossible to perceive. The Dhamma is vast and impossible to perceive, I think. The mind is limited. Oh, I see. That's what it is. The Dhamma is vast, vast, but the mind is limited and unable to perceive it. And I practice anyway. It's that kind of a understanding that we're going to come into. So this, you can see the importance of having this, the truth, this moment in your practice where you believe awakening is possible. And at the same time, you can see how difficult this practice is. And for many practitioners, it's one of the reasons why I think the Buddha said to Ananda that the Sangha was the most important thing in practice. Because when I think about where I was for 10 years as a practitioner by myself, I practiced by myself for 10 years. I probably wallowed around in this third picture for 10 years because all I could do was constantly try to get to where I was when I perceived this understanding. And because we're not really sure what it is that we're perceiving, we are basically creating images of what we think is going on. But in Sangha, when we come together as Sangha, we don't get so tripped up by our own limitations. Like when I was at home by myself trying to practice, I had to ignore a lot of habits because they were too big for me to try to take on. So I just practiced around that habit. You know, practiced kind of threading the needle. So an example would be, there were times when I would sit and meditate and I really didn't feel comfortable, a little bit of restlessness, anxiety. So I just would get up. I mean, why do I would just get up and stop sitting. That would be the end of the meditation. I figured, oh, this is just not a good day to meditate. And I would just stop. But when I started coming to Sims and I had to sit these 40-minute sits, I had to learn to sit with restlessness. Because the sit is 40 minutes and everybody's sitting. So nobody else is getting up. So you sit there too. You know you're dying on the inside, but that's okay. You sit there too. But everybody else, we're just all eyes closed to eat. On the inside, I'm dying, but you know, I'm just doing what everybody else is doing. And somehow the course of that practicing together, we can begin to see that I could actually go beyond my habits. I could actually go beyond the patterns. I can actually begin to practice through these hindrances and the aversions and the desire and the sleepiness, restlessness, doubt. We start practicing beyond that. But without a Sangha, this place right here gets very difficult, because as much as we see the truth and realistic reality of Dhamma, it is overwhelming what it is that we realize that we have to get past in order to free the mind. Let me see if there's something else I want to talk about. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I like the way a teacher described this a little differently. So I'm describing habits and patterns. And what this teacher described was that the ox itself, so what he said was this phrase, what artist can draw that massive head, those massive horns? What he's saying is that, how do I verbalize? How do I conceptualize? How do I communicate something that is outside a separate dualistic understanding when everything I use to communicate is based in a dualistic understanding? So our language itself, we speak in nouns, and that language itself is dualistic. It's already separated. Everything about, like, me trying to describe a majestical or some experience I've had is already dualistic, because you are not having that exact same experience. You are listening to me explain something that happened to me, or you're listening to me explain the Dhamma. And you are now interpreting it based on your own understanding. So there's already a separation there. And what the ox herding tales are pointing to is a non-separate, non-dual understanding. So by its very nature, how do we explain something or understand something that in its very nature is non-dualistic? What he was pointing to is that until we're willing to let all experience be reality, meaning that let everything that's happening co-arise as it's happening, and not try to make ourselves or make the moment other than what it is, we are always living in a separate world. And that somehow this whole process was going to get us to a place where we were willing to accept life just as it is, without the need to make the moment other than that. And that process kind of starts further down. But in these earlier places, we are still trying to live our life dualistically with something, a path that's based on non-dual understanding, meaning it's based on things are as they are and seeing things as it is. The way he described this is this. He said, imagine this. Can you see salt in running water? Can you see the salt if you had the ocean? Can you see the salt in the ocean? We can't see it. It's in there, but we don't see it. It's not visible. He says, can you see the glue that's mixed into a painter's paint? We don't see it. We see the color green. We see the color red, but we don't see that there's also glue in there. And so what we are missing in this first picture is we can't see the aspect of Dhamma that's unseeable, that's invisible to us now. And that aspect of Dhamma is what still has yet to unfold in our minds. Even though we see, even though we've had this direct experience, we almost don't know the directness of the experience we've had. So I don't want to spend up all our time talking about how I perceive this. I want to really hear what you think about this, just what you've heard. It doesn't, you don't even have to know. I'm hoping you don't feel this sense of, I don't really understand the picture yet. I got to think about it a little bit more. You've had direct experience of this Dhamma. You've had the direct experience of whatever you think of as Dhamma. And it's really beginning to talk about and open up about your direct experience with the path, the direct experience of practice. And mostly I'm talking about your direct experience when you have this realization that there is some possibility of awakening, and then you look in the mirror and you're like, oh shit, it's not. Maybe Tuareg can do that, but I don't know. I think I'm a long ways from that. That's what I'm talking about. That's what this picture is pointing to. That direct experience of that, the possibility of freedom, the possibility of being in a completely different existence in the world. And yet, when I look in the mirror, it seems almost impossible for me. That's what this is. So let's take a moment and just sit here and let my words actually move away and see if your words come forth. Thank you so much for your attention here, your practice. So let's just see if anybody has anything they'd like to share, if anything has come up, question, comment, you know, whatever. Yep.
Like you guys know, if you share from in here, you can use this microphone and they can hear you.
So the bull's head, listening to you talking and just kind of what I've been experienced today, is the head feels like remembering. Like I have an aspiration to do more noble silence. And then I just forget. And then I'll just have a moment where I, oh, yeah, all I have to do is remember. And that's the head. for mm-hmm. me, I think, you know, right this moment, that's what's bringing up.
Yeah, the head being the part that you remember. So the missing head is, I don't remember. And then when you remember, the head comes back into view.
Right.
Yes, I could see that, and I could see how majestic, how big it would be, because there's a sense. It's yeah. I can't possibly be the only one in this room that's had a majestical experience with the Dhamma. I know some of you have had it because you wouldn't be here all the time. You've been here with Sims as long as I have. So somehow there's been a sense that there's something here. And yet, you know, we don't feel like we're enlightened. So what is that? That sense that I've been with the Dhamma forever and I believe in it. I know it. And yet I feel like not me. And I guess what I want to point to, the thing that we're trying to point to with these ox herding tales is the normalcy of this, the ordinariness of this, that the idea that you would believe that awakening is possible, but not me, that is ordinary. That is a normal part of being a practitioner. It is not something's wrong with me and I can't quite do it if everybody else can. It really is a normal part of practice. And that's what these tales are for. That's why the teachers use these pictures, is to help their yogis, their students, understand that these places are all quite normal. Yeah, Beth? You hurt yourself.
Oh, dog leash accident.
Oh.
It's getting better.
Okay.
So as you were talking, I was remembering how the various spiritual practices I've tried were an attempt to make myself not broken. Somehow there's something wrong with me and I'm going to step on this path that's going to put me back together. And what sealed me in the Dharma were two things. One, that I didn't have to do that. When I finally, you know, I felt more relaxed, I guess. And I think it was a Sangha experience that, the welcoming and the relaxing experience of being around others in the Sangha. And from almost the beginning, an understanding that's not of the mind, that whatever this enlightenment will be is already here. And I'm just going to try to see if I can see it.
Yeah.
And the relief of not having to fix myself. If nothing else happens, that's good enough.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. I think that this picture is probably pointing, Beth, to before you realized you didn't have to fix yourself. It's pointing to the times when you saw the possibility that liberation is possible, but you don't necessarily, you haven't seen that you don't have to fix yourself yet. I think by the time we get to I don't have to fix myself, we've gotten further down the road here. So this is more at that place when you actually believe that it's possible to be free, and yet you still believe it might be impossible to fix you. You see that? Can you guys see that? I can see you can. You still might question whether or not you can do it. So maybe we should start there and see how many of us think that awakening is possible. Yeah. That's where you got to start. How and where does that come from, this idea that awakening is possible? When did you come to that understanding? And that moment when you, or that realization when you realize that you believe that awakening is possible, then, yeah, that's when you saw the ox. And if you don't believe awakening is possible, you know, it might take a while. It might take me a few more lifetimes before that happens. But if you don't believe awakening is possible, I don't know if you have to call the ox awakening. You could also, do you believe that it's possible for you to not suffer? Or do you believe that you will suffer until the day you die? And there's no, I don't mean suffer like, yeah, we're going to have bad stuff happen to us until the day we die. But do you believe that it's possible that you can go through life in a more equanimous way, that you can handle whatever comes your way? Come what may, I can handle it. I may not like it, but I can handle it. And that's the question that I think the ox is pointing to. Yeah, Iris.
I think the part about the Dhamma is that I don't have to believe anything really. I just have to keep practicing. My experience of learning to take things less personally, and you know, understanding that causes and conditions lead to the present moment, and to see how you know, seeking comfort in traditional ways may provide temporary comfort, but not deep happiness. So it's more the experience of the Dhamma that leads me on the path. And I know I'm not speaking specifically to where it's the picture. It's hard for me to kind of do that. I guess along the years of my practice, you know, I have glimpses of experience and insight that I don't know if I'm gonna awaken, you know, in this lifetime, but the path is worth being on, even if I don't.
How come
it's worth being on? Because of less suffering that I experience. And
directly.
Directly.
That is what the bull is. That less suffering that you experience directly. That even though, on one hand, you experience the less suffering directly, that's the scene of the bull. But then you look at your everyday, ordinary life and you see, oh, yeah, we got a lot of work to do. That is the not seeing the head. That is the, oh my God, that's the harder part. The direct experience of less suffering is the seeing the bull. And then realizing that you may have had that direct experience one day, and then you know, the next several days is difficult. That this is what this is what it is that it's pointing to. Because that direct experience of not suffering is what keeps you practicing even when it doesn't seem like your practice is producing results. When you still have suffering, right? When you don't, when you have less suffering, that's one thing. But when you still have suffering and you still practice, that is a result of that direct experience that you had.
Yeah.
Yeah. And when I say belief, you know, I don't mean belief like, don't even think about it, just do it. I mean belief like exactly what I'm pointing to is that that direct experience is what leads you into what I would call the belief that this practice leads to less suffering. And so even though I'm doing this practice and I have suffering, it doesn't mean to you any longer. You're not questioning whether or not it leads to less suffering. You've already had the direct experience that it does. When we're in the glimpses in picture two, you're not quite sure that you believe that this is going to lead to less suffering. All this meditation and all this stuff I'm doing, you're not quite sure. You've had some glimpses that maybe it does, but you don't have the direct experience. And in this third picture, it's what you're saying. You've had the direct experience that the practice leads to less suffering. And so even though you still suffer, you keep practicing anyway.
Yes, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Something that stood out for me about this third picture or the verse that goes with it is, to me, the description of the scene was very idyllic. It sounded like, you know, the weather's nice and the scenery's nice and we're comfortable and the nightingale is singing. So what that made me think of at first was when things are going pretty well in my life, or there are many things that are giving me joy or stability, then when something difficult arises, it's easier, I feel more resilient, and then maybe I remember the teaching and I can kind of work with that one difficulty more easily because I have a lot of other things that feel easier in my life at that moment. And I've definitely had that experience. But then I remembered that I've also had the experience of having suffering around some issue, some anxiety, maybe for a number of days, kind of wallowing in it, kind of knowing how I could practice with it, but it feels too hard. And it almost feels like after, for example, a number of days, I just hit a point where I'm just kind of, I don't want to suffer anymore, but I had to suffer for that number of days to reach that point where I'm just, I have that momentum almost, or that stronger willingness to let go of that pattern of thought because it's making me suffer too much. But then there are things that are a lot, that's sort of the, it's almost like three tiers of suffering. And then there's the really big stuff that I know I can see I could apply the same type of practice to really big fears, really huge things in the world. But I shy away from it because it just feels too scary. I'm at a point where I believe it's possible to reach equanimity with those things too. But it almost feels like if I turn towards them, I would, you know, initially my fear or whatever it is would kind of rev up and I would have to sit with it for a long time for something to change. And it's almost like, well, I can't do that in my everyday life. I can't just fall apart. I have work to do. I have places to be.
Yep.
So there's never a good time to practice with the really hard stuff.
So tell me about when you have that kind of direct experience of feeling like I got this. I'm okay. I can do it.
It's a combination. I'm trying to think of moments that I've actually experienced. I think it was often the Dhamma, a teaching, a talk was fresh in my mind. So I kind of had refreshed my awareness of, oh, there's a different way. For example, there's a way to suspend judgment of this person or of this behavior. And then I experience something with the person where I'm usually very judgmental or upset. And I remember that that's possible. And for some reason that day, I feel the capacity to withhold judgment, both because I see that it is, the judgment is just a thought and a very limited point of view, but also I have enough that's giving me joy or stability in my life that the mind is less inclined to kind of have to fight to be right in that moment, to build some sense of me around that.
Right. That what you're describing is what this picture is pointing to, that in the moment when we have the ability to have this direct experience of this understanding of Dhamma in this present moment, there's no distinction between the Dhamma and the moment. There's no distinction. So I don't have to sort of remember the talk that tells me that I should be nice to this person. I don't have to remember that. Somehow the talk, the remembering, being nice, the person, all happen at the same time. There's no separation. It's all fluid. It just sort of happens. And then we try to have that happen again and it doesn't. So there's a kind of a disjointedness that begins to happen. And that's what we're going to see in the next month. But in this month, there's this realization that it just sort of happens. That this hearing the song of the nightingale, the sun is warm, the wind is mild, and the willows are green. What it's pointing to is that, like you say, the moment itself is completely, it's not separate. My ability to just directly experience kindness has nothing, I don't have to think about it. It just sort of flows out. However, you know, it just sort of rolls off the tongue. I say something kind. I don't even know how that happened. It just happened. And it's sort of like what Cheryl and Beth, what we're pointing to is this even Iris, this direct experience that happens in non-suffering. And that sort of helps us realize, oh yeah, this Dhamma is real. But what you're also pointing to is what we're going to talk about next month, is that then we try to apply that Dhamma and it doesn't always work. It's when we start actually trying to apply it to make it work that it doesn't work. But when it just happens, and I don't know how it happened or why it happened, but somehow I was just able to be okay with that. That experience is the direct experience of Dhamma. And where we go as practitioners, the next natural stage is, how do I control that Dhamma so I can make it happen? How do I control it so I can make it stay this way forever? How can I make myself, you know, practice or be nice all the time? I can't believe how many people say, how can I, you know, what do I need to do to stop being so angry? I don't know. I'm still angry and I've been practicing 30 years. I don't know. But there's a way in which we, how do I get the Dhamma to make me stop being so restless or stop doing this or stop doing that? And it doesn't. That's what we're going to face next month. But for this month, it's what you're pointing to, what all of you guys are pointing to. There's this direct experience. And in that direct experience, it flows almost without any effort. Somehow I'm able to have a moment when I'm not challenged. I don't lose it. It's real. I know it comes from what I practiced. I know it comes from the Dhamma talks I hear. I know it comes from the Dhamma, but I'm not quite sure how it happened or why or what. Yeah. It just seems doable. And that's what I think that's where we're at. And that's what I think it's important that we recognize those direct experiences. It's important that we recognize that having the direct experience, just like the glimpses were important to keep us on the path, this direct experience also keeps us on the path. Even though we got to face our habits and we got to face the reality that we don't know how to make ourselves be awake all the time. So there is everything's going right, like in this picture, but it is because the Dhamma flows out and it's not something I have to figure out how to make it happen. It's non-dualistic is what it is. All right, great. Thank you. Well, we got to stop. What was I going to say? Oh, about the practice. About the practice for this month. So this is Tim's month. I'm covering for him because he's at the Grand Canyon. And so, but I do think we should begin to think about the direct experience of Dhamma you've had. Begin to think about the direct experiences you've had of this realization that you could live without suffering. And then that's what we're going to talk about this month, at least the way I see it. Tim might come here next week. Be prepared. He might say something completely different. That's okay. That's the whole point. All right. All right, good. Well, thank you all for being here. Thank you for continuing to support Sims. Seattle Insight, we really need some support. All sanghas need support. I mean, all sanghas. I teach at so many sanghas all over the country, and we all need to make sure we go back to volunteering and we financially support the organizations because, you know, COVID kind of changed everything, and I understand that, but yeah, we have been here the whole time. Seattle Insight never left, no matter what happened with COVID. And so just make sure you continue to support us to keep us together. All right. And I won't see you next week, but I'll see you next month. All right. Thank you so much.